Welcome to That Was Radio, where we explore all aspects of the golden age of radio, not just the radio programs themselves, but also the personalities and events that shaped those programs. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio. On today's program, we're going to discuss probably the most famous action hero of all times. His radio opening is so famous that many people still recognize it today.
Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman!
Superman is the most popular comic book character of all time, with total sales of over 600 million, about 150 million more than any other comic. That, combined with his many television and movie appearances, make him a character that truly needs no introduction. So, on this program, I'll provide a little about the origin of the character, and then discuss Superman's adventures on radio. The Superman character was created by a couple of teenage boys in Cleveland, Ohio, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. They were best friends and had worked together on their high school's newspaper. Joe drew cartoons and Jerry wrote stories. By the time they finished high school, they had begun publishing what would be considered today fanzines. In 1933, when they were 19, they published a story called Reign of Superman, in which the lead character had extraordinary powers but was a villain. A year later, Siegel and Shuster decided to revise their idea using a superhero rather than a villain. They then tried to sell this storyline to several newspapers, but without success. In 1936, the pair began working on various feature stories for DC Comics. In 1938, DC's publisher began looking for material to start a new anthology magazine to be called Action Comics. Siegel and Shuster convinced him to use their superhero idea. The comics featuring Superman were an immediate success. In January 1939, newspapers began carrying a syndicated Superman comic strip. Later that year, Superman became the first character to have his own comic book series. Even though Superman comics were a great success, DC Comics' publicity office realized that radio would increase the character's popularity even more. Comic books could reach perhaps 100,000 readers a month. Radio could reach millions every day. So in February 1940, Superman took to the air as a transcribed, syndicated series. The series was produced at station WOR in New York, and was sponsored by Hecker's Oats, which had sponsored the very popular Bobby Benson Cowboy series. The Superman series was initially carried by only about 10 stations, but the ratings were so good that by 1941, the program was being carried by 63. The series was then picked up by the Mutual Broadcasting System in February of 1942. In January of 1943, the series sponsorship was picked up by Kellogg's Pep. Over the years, the radio series provided several different versions of Superman's origin. Here is one compiled from September of 1945.
Yes, it's Superman. And today, the Man of Steel tells a story, a wondrous story of the planet Krypton and how he, Superman, came to Earth. Almost a year ago, as some of you will remember, a flaming meteor fell out of the sky and landed in an open field in a suburb of Metropolis. Brought to the Metropolis Museum by Dr. John Whistler, a famous meteorologist, it was discovered to be a piece of kryptonite, a fragment of the shattered planet Krypton. Sent to interview Dr. Whistler at the museum, Clark Kent, in reality Superman, discovered to his horror that if he approached within a distance of 10 feet of the strange green glowing meteor, he lost all his strength. Panic-stricken, he influenced Whistler to seal the meteor in a private vault. But now the meteorologist is dead, and Kent is fearful lest the vault be opened and the dangerous piece of kryptonite fall into strange hands. As we continue now, Lois Lane and editor Perry White are at Kent's apartment, where Kent is about to tell them why he seems so worried. Listen.
This is a strange story you're about to hear. I just hope I can trust you to let it go no further.
No, don't be a fool, Kent. What is it?
Well, it concerns Superman.
Superman?
Yes. As you may or may not know, Superman was the only survivor of the planet Krypton when it exploded in space many years ago. He came to Earth as an infant and grew up to discover that he had strange and unusual powers. I mean, he had impenetrable skin and tremendous strength and the ability to withstand fire and flame. He also had the power to leap great distances and to sustain himself in midair. Oh, perhaps I better go back and tell you the whole story, huh?
What story?
The story of how Superman came to Earth, Chief.
What? Well, how do you know that, Clark?
I'll explain later, Lois. First, I want to take you on a far journey, millions of miles from the Earth, where, not so many years ago, the planet Krypton burned like a wondrous star in the heavens. Here, civilization was far advanced. It had brought forth a race of supermen, men and women like ourselves, but advanced to the absolute peak of human perfection.
Yes?
As we near Krypton, we see high walls and gleaming turrets. We approach the magnificent Temple of Wisdom with its dome of pure crystal shimmering like a diamond in the sun. There, in a great marble hall, Jor-El, Krypton's leading man of science, is about to address a special meeting of the planet's governing council.
Council members, I have completed my solar calculations, and much as I dread uttering these fateful words, I have come to the conclusion that Krypton is doomed.
Gentlemen, 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 hear him out.
Let me try and explain, gentlemen. The sun is gradually drawing Krypton closer to it. Within a month, possibly only a week, the gravitational pull will be so tremendous that Krypton will not be able to weather the strain. And then our planet will explode like a giant bubble, destroying every living thing on it.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, assuming for the moment, Jor-El, that what you say is true, how are we to avoid this catastrophe facing us? How can we stop it?
It cannot be stopped, Roseanne. It's a force of nature that even we, who are supermen, are powerless to prevent. But there is one way to escape.
Escape? What do you mean?
As you know, I've been working these many months on a model of a spaceship, which in its final form is designed to carry the entire population of Krypton to another planet. If you will assign to me 1,000 skilled workmen, I will endeavor to construct the spaceship before the end comes.
It is all well and good, Jor-El, to speak of spaceships, but where would we go?
To the planet Earth. My studies tell me this planet has an atmosphere almost identical with our own.
Jor-El, you have been working too hard. You need a rest. Believe me, we have the utmost respect for your knowledge and integrity, but this is too much. Planets as large as Krypton do not explode.
Wait! Wait, do you hear that, gentlemen?
I hear only a distant thunder.
It is not thunder, Roseanne. That's an internal eruption gas exploding in giant pockets. You're listening to the forewarning of doom. Quakes like that are sounding the death knell of Krypton. It will happen, gentlemen, and happen soon. And when the last great eruption comes...
When it comes, Jor-El, we will all be ready for it. If Krypton is to perish, we will perish with it. But I assure you, Jor-El, your beard will be long enough to trip over before that time arrives.
Very well, laugh if you wish, Roseanne. Laugh, all of you. But a time will come, and that time is perhaps very close at hand when you'll wish you had heeded the words of Jor-El.
Order, gentlemen, order. Members of the Governing Council, you have heard Jor-El speak. Is it your wish that we devote time and energy to build a spaceship in order, as Jor-El suggests, the entire population of Krypton be transported to the planet known as the Earth?
No!
All in favor, say aye. The Council has spoken, Jor-El.
Yes, and signed the death warrant of every living thing on Krypton. There remains only one thing for me to do. Prepare for the salvation of my wife, Lara, my infant son, and myself. As for the rest of you, may God have mercy on your soul.
Leaving the Temple of Wisdom with a mocking laughter of the council members ringing in his ears, Jor-El hurried to the terrace of his hilltop home and feverishly set to work on the steel model of his spaceship. Time was short, as he alone knew. A matter of days, possibly only hours. Driving home the last rivet, he stepped back to examine the bullet-shaped spaceship, only to discover his young wife standing behind him.
Oh, Lara, I didn't hear you come out.
You were too intent on your work. What did the council say, Jor-El?
They laughed at me, Lara. Marked me for a fool.
Even Roseanne?
Oh, he above all. But no matter. The model is finished now, and tomorrow at dawn I'll send it on its way, watching its flight through the high-powered telescope on the observatory roof. And once I have proven to myself that it works, I will begin building a spaceship large enough to carry all three of us to the planet Earth.
Jor-El, I feel faint. It, it seems to have grown oppressively hot. Is that because we're being drawn closer to the sun?
Yes, there's a strange glow on the western sky. I don't like it. Where is Kal-El?
Asleep. I had quite a time with him. He was restless all day. Jor-El, what was that?
An internal quake. A bad one.
Jor-El, the house is shaking.
Easy, Lara, easy.
What's happening?
It may pass over. You'd better go in.
No. No, my place is with you. Jor-El, look. The sky, it's darkening.
Lara, this is the end. Krypton is breaking apart.
Jor-El!
We'll return in a moment to find out what happened on the planet Krypton.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM, where we're featuring the radio series The Adventures of Superman.
And now, back to The Adventures of Superman. In his guise of Clark Kent, Superman is telling Lois Lane and Perry White of the last minutes on the doomed planet Krypton. How his father, Jor-El, had just completed an experimental model of a spaceship when a strange blood-red glow appeared in the sky, and a series of thunderous crashes and deep rumbles, increasing in intensity, shook the ground under the feet of Jor-El and Lara, his young wife.
Lara, this is the end. Krypton is breaking apart.
What can we do, Jor-El?
Oh, nothing. I was a fool for waiting this long.
Oh, it wasn't your fault, Jor-El. The council...
Oh, I should have built a spaceship months ago, and now we have only a model. Oh, but wait. It can carry one of us to safety. You, Lara.
No. No, if only one of us could be saved, it should be our son. You wait here, I'll get him.
Lara! Lara! No, perhaps she's right. It should be the boy. Oh, now, if I can only get this atomic generator working, build up enough pressure, I hope there's time. There.
Jor-El.
Yes?
Here he is, still fast asleep.
Here, I'll open the door. Now, put him inside. Gently.
Jor-El, are you sure?
Hurry, hurry, Lara.
He's in, Jor-El.
Here, good. Now, stand back, Lara. Pressure's building up.
How long will it take?
Oh, I don't know.
Look, the Temple of Wisdom's on fire. All the towers are crumbling.
Here, come close to me, Lara. The end is not far off. The mountains are breaking up.
Jor-El, the pressure. What's happening?
It's building up slowly. Perhaps you're too late if it doesn't happen soon. Lara, it's gone. Our son is on his way to Earth.
Screaming through space, the tiny steel rocket headed toward Earth, leaving the glowing fragments of the exploding planet Krypton behind it.
Good heavens, Clark.
Go on, Kent. That baby in the rocket, it was Superman, wasn't it?
Yes, Chief. That is, he grew up to be the person we know as Superman. The rocket landed in a farmer's field not very far from here. The farmer and his wife rescued the baby and reared him as their own son. They gave him their name and they
said... What name, Clark?
Clark. He came to be known as Superman, of course, Lois.
Naturally.
Clark, how do you know all this?
Why, you might say I'm in Superman's confidence, Lois.
It's a great story for our Sunday magazine section. Oh, by the way, what happened to the farmer and his wife, Kent?
They both died a few years ago.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, go ahead, Kent.
Well, as we know, Superman has been of invaluable help to us. Time and again, he saved us from injury and... well, even death.
You can say that again.
Well, therefore, anything that may place him in danger is our concern.
Place Superman in danger? Are you kidding?
Unfortunately, I'm not, Lois.
Well, now, listen.
That piece of kryptonite you mentioned is Superman's deadliest enemy.
Eh?
What did you say?
I said that piece of kryptonite is Superman's deadliest enemy. If he comes within 10 feet of it, he loses all his strength and powers.
Who told you that fantastic story?
Kent, are you out of your mind?
All right, I don't blame either one of you for doubting me. But unfortunately, my only witness, Dr. Whistler, is dead. He alone could tell you that due to some unexplained chemical or physical action, that the piece of kryptonite, when placed in the Earth's atmosphere, robbed Superman of his strength.
You mean that Dr. Whistler tested it on Superman?
Yes. That's why he sealed the meteor in his private vault at the museum.
Well, now...
we were at war then, and Superman was too valuable to run the risk of placing him in danger. Well, now you know why I turned pale when I read about Whistler's sudden death. I could just see that vault being opened by those who had no knowledge of the meteor's power. And I could see it falling into the hands of Superman's enemies. That's what shocked me. And it still does.
You shouldn't wonder.
Clark, you're not making this up, are you?
Oh, hardly, Lois. As a matter of fact, the only reason I'm telling you the story is because I need your help to destroy that piece of kryptonite forever. If it's not destroyed, Superman may be destroyed.
Well, there's only one answer to that. We'll get the museum and authorities to give the meteor up, take it out into the middle of the ocean, and dump it.
Well, if that could be done, Chief, we'll have repaid our debt to Superman.
Why not? I've got some influence in this city. As a matter of fact, I'm on the board of directors of the museum. I'll call the chairman first thing in the morning.
Well, that'd be wonderful, Chief.
For most of its run, The Adventures of Superman was a 15-minute serial with 3 or 5 episodes per week. In October 1949, Superman moved to the ABC network as a 30-minute program that aired at various times from 1 to 3 times a week until the final radio broadcast in March of 1951. In the vast majority of the episodes, Clayton Bud Collier provided the voice for Superman and Clark Kent on radio, and Joan Alexander provided that of Lois Lane. Bud Collier was a radio veteran. His career included major roles in many popular radio series, a few of which included Terry and the Pirates, Renfrew of the Mounted, AB's Irish Rose, and The March of Time. He also served as the announcer for the prestigious series Cavalcade of America and for several other programs. Initially, Collier wasn't interested in taking the role of Superman. The following clip is from an interview where he and Joan Alexander talked with Richard Lamparski.
I enjoyed it. I tell you, it was a funny thing, though, on that show, because when we all came to audition for this new idea, the Superman thing, we knew about the comic strip and everything. They didn't know whether they wanted one man for each part, Clark Kent and Superman, or whether they wanted two. Didn't know how it should be played or anything. And when I heard that, when I was auditioning for it, I fought with Bob Maxwell, who owned the writing thing. I said, this is not for me. You know, the whole idea embarrassed me. I said, no. He said, we'll just audition, and we'll use you all in some parts if it goes on the air. Well, it did go on the air, and came in, and he said, you're Superman. And I again took the script, handed it to him, and tried to walk out and get out of the show. I really fought to unload it right then and there. The whole thing embarrassed me so. Then, of course, it grew into a magnificent, really career within career.
As we just heard, when the producers were first casting the radio program, they weren't sure whether they wanted one actor to do the voices of both Superman and Clark Kent, or a different actor for each part. Collier was able to alter his voice sufficiently that the listener could easily distinguish which character was speaking. He used a gentle, easygoing tenor for Clark Kent and lower, gravelly baritone for Superman. Another problem that radio faced, as opposed to movies or television, was how do you know when Superman is flying? Since you couldn't see Superman as he launched himself into flight, Collier used the phrase, up, up, and away, to cue the audience. This, combined with the sound effects of wind blowing, worked quite well in providing listeners with a mental picture. Here's a brief example of how it was done.
Well, he's got 20 minutes start on me, but if he sticks to the highway, I shouldn't have any trouble finding a bright yellow convertible. There, it's dark enough out here, so I won't be seen. Out of these clothes. This is a job
for Superman. There we are. All set. Now, up, up, and away!
After two other women put in short stints in the part, Joan Alexander became radio's Lois Lane and remained in the role for 11 years. After an early modeling and stage career, Alexander became a versatile performer on dozens of radio serials, including Perry Mason, where she played Mason's loyal secretary, Della Street. She also had recurring roles on radio soap operas and dramas, including Lone Journey, The Guiding Light, and This Is Nora Drake. However, her first few months on The Adventures of Superman had some rough going, as she mentions in another part of the interview she and Bud Collier did with Richard Lamparski.
Anyway, you know what I remember? Do you remember when I was fired from Superman, Bud?
Yes.
I was fired from the part of Lois Lane about 3 months after I got it, and Bud said, if you're going to audition other girls, let Joan audition back for her part. And I said, well, that seems kind of silly, but I auditioned blind back for the part and got it, won it again.
Why were you fired?
You didn't like me.
I don't really know why.
That was any good.
Joan is one of those rare actresses, especially in the medium of radio, where you couldn't be seen. It'd have been entirely on voice. She could go on in something cold, and her instincts are so right as an actress that with even a rehearsal or a read-through, she would have been right.
Thank you.
I mean it. She's a great joy to work with. Great joy.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM. I'm Leon Smothers. On radio, Clark Kent was a stronger and more intelligent character than he had been in the comics, where he was often portrayed as a spineless wimp. In a 2006 article, author Elizabeth McLeod says, "The radio Kent evolved into a far more dynamic character, a crusading newspaper man who believed passionately in what he was doing and, one suspects, really didn't need superpowers to be effective. Kent generally got most of the airtime doing the legwork investigating stories that helped expose crime and corruption. Superman would then come in when superpowers were needed." Lois Lane was a strong, career-minded woman at a time when this type of role model for young women wasn't common. She first appeared in the same comic book issue that introduced Superman. However, she didn't appear in the radio series until episode number 7. In a December 2018 article, Alex Kranz says this about radio's Lois Lane. "This Lois isn't a good enough reporter to work out who Superman really is, and she lacks the obsessive drive some later Lois Lanes possessed to prove Clark Kent and Superman are the same. Yet, she's a tough-as-heck gal, eager to get the story, even if that means infiltrating the bases of mad scientists or fighting off Nazis." Much of the lore and many of the supporting characters associated with Superman originated in the radio series. The Daily Planet's Perry White and Jimmy Olsen were originally created for radio. Kryptonite, the substance that renders Superman helpless, was introduced in his radio adventures long before it appeared within the pages of the Superman comics. Superman also regularly teamed up with Batman and Robin on radio before the trio joined forces in the comic books. The program used a serial format. Each episode moved the plot along a little bit and provided some new information. Quite often, an episode would end with one of the characters in a dangerous situation. The story arcs often ran from 6 to 10 episodes, but occasionally they would run for more than 20. While radio's Superman was sometimes called upon to battle with mad scientists or supervillains, he was more often heard fighting the crimes associated with greedy industrialists, corrupt politicians, gangsters, and racketeers of the day. The program's introduction said he stood for truth and justice, and they meant it. After World War II, the adventures of Superman became even more dedicated to social awareness, especially in fighting bigotry and racism. In a 1946 article, Newsweek said, "Superman is the first children's program to develop a social consciousness. To do it, Superman Incorporated, the company that controls the Man of Tomorrow in all media, had to sell the idea to the Kellogg Company sponsors and Mutual, two perpetual worriers over the response of their reactionary listeners. Fortunately, everyone was pleased with the move since the show started pulling its highest ratings ever." For today's program, I've chosen an episode entitled "The Mystery of the $10,000 Ghost" that originally aired on March the 4th, 1949.
Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman!
Yes, it's Superman, strange visitor from the planet Krypton, who came to Earth with amazing physical powers far beyond those of mortal men, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, wages a never-ending battle for truth and justice. Today, transcribed in a place which supposedly has ceased to exist, Superman fights for the lives of two close friends in The Mystery of the $10,000 Ghost.
Our scene is a small one-story bank building in a long-dead town, where sagging, paint-cracked frame dwellings, their windows gone, stare blindly out on the single grass-grown street. But oddly enough, The little bank has been freshly painted, and its new plate glass window sparkles from a recent washing. Inside, fresh paint also covers the cracked walls, and rich-looking linoleum hides the rotted floor. Two gleaming new tables and several new chairs have been pulled together, and seated or standing around are a dozen men engaged in a dice game. Standing at the window are two other men. One is tall, dark, aquiline-featured, distinguished-looking, in a frock coat and striped trousers. His companion, who is scarcely half his height, is dressed in boy's clothing and smokes a long black cigar. He is known as Shortcake, and now, puffing nervously on his cigar, he addresses the tall man.
Roll up. Come on, over there.
It's taken Ed a long time to get here with this sucker, Lucky.
I'll be along soon, Shortcake.
I wish they'd hurry up.
Relax.
That's okay for you to say, Lucky. You ain't got any nerves. With me, I'm what you call high-strung. You know, nervous.
Well, there's nothing to be nervous about, Shortcake.
I don't know. This new sucker, what's his name?
Adolph Melcher.
Yeah, well, he'll be the sixth one. Pretty soon, the cops will start wondering what happened to all them missing guys.
Let them wonder. They'll never be able to trace them here.
You hope.
I know. This is a ghost town. It's not even on the map. Nobody lives here except rats and ghosts.
I don't like this place.
Now, cheer up. We'll be back in the big town tonight. Wait, Shortcake. They're coming.
Well, I don't see.
The car just turned out of the pass into the old road. See it?
Yes, Ed.
And the sucker Melcher is with him. Now, in just a few minutes now, Adolph Melcher will add $10,000 to our treasury. And one ghost to the town's population.
The mystery of the $10,000 ghost. Superman's newest adventure, complete in one episode, will continue in just a moment.
Years ago today, gang, a famous American hero was born in Poland. He was born a nobleman, a count, to great wealth in the States. He could have lived out his life in luxury. Instead, this man, Count Kazimierz Pulaski, gave up everything, his home, his wealth, his power, to join his fellow countrymen in their fight for liberty against a tyrannical Russian czar. When the Polish people lost the gallant fight, Pulaski had to flee his homeland. It was then he heard about some people called Americans who lived way across the ocean. He heard how they were fighting against another tyrant. So Count Pulaski crossed the Atlantic and offered his services to General George Washington. He led American troops in the fiercest battles, the most grueling ordeals. His orders were issued in a thick Polish accent. His accent was strange to American ears, but the things he fought for were familiar to American hearts. He was killed in 1779 while leading American soldiers in the Battle of Savannah. Since Pulaski's heroic sacrifice, millions of men and women with foreign-sounding names like his have come here to build this country up, to keep it strong and free. Today, our government continues to protect and strengthen our American rights, to make sure that equal opportunities are enjoyed by all our citizens, native-born and foreign-born alike. In doing so, America is paying the deepest kind of tribute to Pulaski and to all the others like him of every country, creed, and race under the sun. That is the finest homage we can give to the brave men from all over the world who came to America when she was in need and made her great.
And now, back to the adventures of Superman and the mystery of the $10,000 ghost.
In his office at the Metropolis Daily Planet, one of the country's great newspapers, Editor Perry White is in conference with his star reporter, Clark Kent, who, unknown to all, is really Superman.
Something's got to be done, Kent. This Adolph Melcher is the third person to disappear from Metropolis in the last 5 months.
What about the police?
They haven't been able to find hide a hair of Melcher or of the other two either.
That's strange. People don't just disappear into thin air.
Well, these three birds seem to have done just that, Kent. They dropped out of sight and they haven't been heard from since. All fairly substantial citizens, too.
Well, what about their families? They ought to have some ideas.
None of them had families. All bachelors.
Oh?
All of them were fairly recent and never goods from Europe, by the way. Oh, yes, and get this. Each of them drew $10,000 from the bank on the day he disappeared.
Each of them?
That's right. And they weren't planning trips back to the old country, either.
How do you know?
Well, A, the police are sure they didn't leave the country. B, each of them was a shopkeeper. But none of them said anything to their employees about going away.
makes it look like foul play, Chief.
Well, I'm glad you got the idea at last, Kent. Now, as mayor of Metropolis, I'm concerned about the welfare of these three citizens.
Naturally.
And as editor of the Daily Planet, I smell a big story. You're elected to get it.
Me?
You. You always fancied yourself a great detective. Here's your chance to show up Inspector Henderson.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Now, get going now. I've told Henderson to give you all the information he has.
I'm on my way, Chief.
And don't come back until...
Until I found Adolph Melcher and the other two.
Right.
I thought so. So long, you slave driver.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM.
That spooky ghost town gives me the creeps at night, Lucky. Why couldn't we wait till morning to drive out?
We're having company at the bank in the morning, Shortcake. Another one of your uncles.
Oh. Is this uncle going to bring us some more of that nice green cabbage?
Naturally. $10,000 worth.
Oh, I love that holding money. Who's the sucker this time?
A fella named Anton Lazinski from Metropolis.
Hey, that's the fourth one from Metropolis. Ain't that pushing your luck a little too far?
Leave it to me. I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, but the cops, they...
Let me worry about the cops. And with this sneak set up, I am not worrying. Now step on it, Shortcake. We've got work to do before we cash in our next $10,000 ghost tomorrow.
Speaking.
Chief, this is Clark Kent. I think I've got a lead to those three men who disappeared.
Wonderful. Let's have it.
Well, I'd rather not talk about it on the phone. I can use a little help, though. What's Jim Olson doing?
I sent him up to Willow Falls on the flood story.
Oh? How about Lois Lane?
Ah, Lois. She's off chasing ghosts with that crackpot.
Ghosts? What crackpot?
The correspondent school sleuth. The Sherlock Holmes of Screen Run.
Oh, you mean our rural correspondent Horatio Horn.
That's the idiot.
Horatio Horn may be a little eccentric, Chief.
A little?
But he's got a head on his shoulders.
Yeah, so has a baboon.
All right. What's this about chasing ghosts?
Well, how do I know? Something about a ghost town. I didn't want Lois to waste time, but Horn was already in the city at the railroad station, in fact, and chattering his fool head off on the phone,
so... I get it. Lois insisted on meeting him. Well, that lets her out. Can you lend me Tony Sloan?
Sure, if you need him. Where are you?
A rooming house at 1061 Archer Avenue.
1061 Archer. I'll send Tony right out.
Thanks. And when you hear from Lois, tell her to save a ghost for me. So long, Chief.
Here's a taxi, Miss Lane. Get in, please.
All right, Horatio, but I wish you'd tell
later,
me what...
Later. Not a moment to waste right now. 2836 West Street, driver. And do hurry, please.
What's at 2836 West Street, Horatio?
Mr. Anton Lazinski, of course.
And who, may I ask, is Mr. Anton Lazinski?
Why, the name of the man on the letter.
Oh, this is like pulling teeth. What letter, Horatio?
The one the man deposited in my post office in Screen Run yesterday afternoon. I'm the postmaster, you know, as well as a telegrapher.
And a digger of artesian wells and a graduate of the infamous correspondence school for homemade private eyes. I know, Horatio.
The famous international correspondence school for detectives and crime deduction, Miss Lane.
Horatio, please get down to cases. You said on the phone that you had hold of a terrific story.
I'm sure I have, by Gulliver. What would you say when a man sends letters from a ghost bank in a ghost town?
I'd say he was probably a ghost, except that there aren't any ghosts.
Exactly.
Elucidate further, Horatio. This is beginning to sound interesting.
Well, as I say, this man, whom I never saw before, deposited a letter in my post office in Screen Run yesterday.
Yes?
The envelope, a fine, expensive envelope, by the way, was engraved the First National Bank of Nugget City.
Nugget City? I never heard of it.
Of course you didn't. Nugget City has been a ghost town for 48 years.
Oh?
And what I want to know is, why did this man send a letter from a bank which no longer exists in a town which no longer exists?
I don't know, unless it was a gag.
A what?
A trick, a joke.
Oh, I don't think so. this man was definitely a criminal type. The smooth, confidence man type.
Oh, come now, Horatio. You couldn't possibly tell that.
I am a trained observer, Miss Lane. And to the trained observer, many things are apparent. As a matter of fact, I wrote my thesis on that subject for the famous international
correspondence
school.
Oh, now spare me, Horatio, please. I still think it's a gag, but I've wasted all this time, so I might as well waste a little more. The letter was addressed to Mr. Anton Lazinski here in the Providence?
Yes, that's right. 2836 West Street.
Well, we're turning into West Street now. Let's see what Mr. Lazinski has to say.
You say there is no Nugget City, Mr. Ford?
It's been deserted. A ghost town for 48 years, Mr. Lazinski.
Well, I do not understand. I have a letter from the president of the bank.
It's easy enough to have letterheads printed, Mr. Lazinski. Look, why don't you tell us all about it? We want to help you.
Well, the man said it is better not to mention about it until everything is arranged, Miss Lane. But if you are right, if perhaps there is dishonesty...
Let's hear the story before we decide.
Yes, you can trust us, Mr. Lazinski.
Your newspaper, The Daily Planet, is a fine paper. I will tell you.
Good. Let's have good. It.
I come here from the old country 7 years ago. I come alone. My wife, my children, all were killed by the Nazis.
What a shame.
I open an optical shop. I do fairly well, but I am lonesome.
Of course.
Last week, a gentleman calls me. He says he is from the government.
Well.
The young son of a distant cousin whom I have never seen has just arrived in America. A DP. He, too, is all alone. But he knows of me. He has considerable money from his father, which is, how you say, frozen by our government.
Yes, frozen, that's right.
The man tells me, if I am a responsible person, I can adopt this boy, my young blood relative. His money, $100,000, will be entrusted to me.
$100,000?
Yes, there will be money to educate him and to care for me in my old age. I say I am glad. And the man asks me, can I put up $10,000 as a bond, he says, to show my responsibility and good faith?
Uh-oh.
I say I can do this, and the man from the government says he will have me investigated. If all goes well, I will hear from the president of the Nugget City Bank, where my young relative's money is. He says it is best not to discuss this with anyone during the investigation.
Oh.
So, this morning, I receive a letter from the president of the bank.
What did it say, Mr. Lazinski?
That I have been investigated and found to be of good character. Tomorrow morning, a limousine will call for me to take me to the Nugget City Bank, where my young relative will be waiting.
What?
I am to bring $10,000 in cash or securities as a bond. Then the boy and his entire fortune will be turned over to me.
So oh, that's the racket.
Now, wait, Horatio. What else, Mr. Lazinski?
Well, I am to say nothing of this to anyone until everything is complete.
Well, he means he doesn't want the police to find out. This is an out-and-out fraud, Miss Lane, just as I was sure it would be.
It certainly looks that way, Horatio.
Of course it is. Nugget City is a ghost town. These rascals, whoever they are, plan to get Mr. Lazinski out there, take his money, and then maybe kill him.
Kill me?
I think Horatio's right, Mr. Lazinski. I'm going to call Inspector Henderson.
Don't touch that horse, sister.
What
you guys, don't move.
Who are you?
Keep him covered, Dan.
Don't worry, Ed.
Wise guys, huh? You figured out everything, didn't you?
Now,
what does this
here,
mean?
The only thing you didn't figure out is that Lucky would be smart enough to keep a tail on this sucker Lazinski to make sure he didn't give us away.
Who's Lucky?
You're going to find out, sister. And that's about all you ever will find out. Okay, Dan, get them ready for their last trip.
The mystery of the $10,000 ghost will continue in just a moment, so keep listening. Know what causes a whirlpool, boys and girls? An eddy or small current of water which moves in a different direction from the main current. When the two currents hit, the water starts churning around. A dangerous whirlpool has been formed, and any object floating on the surface will be sucked under. Now, among people, the whirlpools whipped up by prejudice are caused by those who run counter to the rest of us. The folks who get all worked up against everybody who's the slightest bit different from themselves. Everything's flowing smoothly until they start their undercurrent of bitterness.
They spread rumors round and round and suck a lot of foolish people into the trouble that they stir up. Fall into this whirlpool of prejudice, boys and girls, and down you go. It gets harder and harder to see clearly. It becomes impossible to keep your head above water. You just go thrashing about, striking out at everything in sight, and never making any headway at all. Now, you can avoid getting into such troubles, gang, just by sticking to the mainstream of friendship. And that flows among sensible folk.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM, where we're featuring an episode of The Adventures of Superman.
And now, back to The Adventures of Superman and the mystery of the $10,000 ghost.
Surprised in Anton Lozinski's house by two armed men, Lois Lane, Horatio Horn, and Mr. Lozinski were drugged, then taken by car from Metropolis to the small bank in the ghost town of Nugget City. Dawn is breaking as Lois and Horn come to in a tiny windowless room in the bank. Mr. Lozinski is still unconscious. By the pencil ray of a tiny flashlight which is fitted into one end of Horn's amazing knife, Lois and the little amateur detective are exploring their dark prison.
Don't make any noise, Horatio. Those men are right outside that door in the bank. The
villains? I'm certain they mean to do away with us, Miss Lane.
Of course they do. We know all about their racket. The only reason we're still alive at all is because Mr. Lozinski brought the $10,000 in bonds.
Uh-huh.
When he comes to, he can endorse the bonds over them. They'll finish him and us, too.
Oh, dear me. How do you know?
Well, they were in here a few minutes ago before you came to. I heard the boss, the one they call Lucky, say so.
Oh, my goodness. We've got to get out of here quickly, then.
But how? That door leads into the bank, and there aren't any windows.
I know. If we could... Wait. What's this?
What?
It's another door.
A door?
Yeah. It's just opposite to the other one. Well, this door must lead outside, by Gulliver.
See if it's unlocked, Horatio. Hurry.
I certainly will. Locked, by crickety.
Oh, I was afraid of that.
Yeah. Just hold this light, Miss Lane, and keep up your spirits. I'll have us out of here in jig time.
Horatio, what are you taking your shoes off for?
You'll see in a moment. There. The heels come off. They're false.
Why, of all... What's that inside them?
Two powerful little dry cell batteries.
Batteries?
Right. Now, if you hold them and give me my knife... Thank you.
Here you are.
I have a miniature power drill in the handle, among other things.
A what?
Miniature power drill. Oh, don't tell me. I forgot it.
Shh, quiet, Horatio.
Here it is. Now, I'll just hook it up to the batteries and then watch me cut the lock out of this old door.
Oh, it won't work.
I think it will. And hear that? It is working. Now, to cut around the lock...
Oh, Horatio, you're wonderful. You're wonderful and crazy. How did you ever think of a thing like that?
Oh... Just a little trick I picked up at the famous International Correspondence Institute.
For detectives and crime deduction, I know.
Just hold the light a little higher, please, Miss Lane.
There, how's this?
Fine. Look, I'm cutting through this rotten old door like butter.
If only they don't hear us in the bank.
Oh, I'm not making much noise. And I'm almost through. We'll show those rascals a thing or two, by Gulliver.
What's that?
The lock fell out. To open the door.
Won't it open?
Seems to be stuck. Help me push, Miss Lane.
Okay. Come on. Hurry.
We're getting it. Push harder.
All right.
Oh, help!
Chief,
oh, here you are, Kent. I tried to reach you all night. Now, where have you been?
Hunting for those three citizens who disappeared so mysteriously, of course.
Well, any luck? You said you had a lead.
I did, a hot one. But it turned out, well, it hasn't turned out at all.
Well, what do you mean?
I finally found a man, the priest in Adolph Melcher's parish, who'd seen Melcher the night before he disappeared. Melcher vanished last week, you know.
Yes, I know. Go on, go on.
The priest asked Melcher if he was coming to Mass the next morning, and Melcher said he couldn't. He had to go to Nugget City.
Where?
To a city or town or whatever it is that doesn't exist.
A town that doesn't exist?
Uh-huh.
What are you talking about?
Sounds crazy, doesn't it? But it's true. The place Melcher told his priest he was going to just doesn't exist.
Well, I'll be...
The way I figure it, Melcher and the other two chaps who disappeared from Metropolis were all victims of a clever swindle of some sort. You remember each of them drew $10,000 from his bank just before he disappeared?
Yes, yes, I know that.
Then they were lured or taken somewhere. They were told they were going to Nugget City just in case they talked.
Oh, say, wait.
In which case, neither the authorities nor anyone else would be able to trace them since there is no Nugget City.
There is a Nugget City.
What?
I just remembered. That's the place, the ghost town that Horatio Horn was talking about.
Ghost town?
Yes, Nugget City. Horn said he was on to some big story about it. Lois went out to meet him.
Where? Where did she meet him?
Oh, at the railroad station. Horn just got into town, but that was yesterday evening.
Haven't you heard from her since then?
No, from Horn either. As a matter of fact, I've been a bit worried.
I'm worried right now. I'm afraid...
Kent, you don't think Lois and Horn fell into the hands of this swindle gang, whoever they are?
That's exactly what I'm afraid of, Chief.
Great Caesar. Well, don't just stand there. Do something. Call Inspector Henderson. Call the FBI.
They're all on the job. But it looks as if only I can help them now.
You?
Yes. Try to remember, Chief. Did Horatio say anything else about Nugget City? Anything to give us a clue to where it is?
No, he didn't.
Oh, there are hundreds of ghost towns in this country. I have to take the time to search them all. Wait a minute. Did Horatio happen to say where he had just come from?
Let me see. Well, yes, come to think of it. He said he just arrived from Screen Run.
And then maybe I can find the answer out there. Horatio has an elderly sister he lives with. She might know something.
Well, I'll put in a long-distance call for her.
I know a faster way to talk to her.
Well, what do you mean? Where are you going, Kent?
I'm on my way. Keep your fingers crossed, Chief. Nobody in my office, I hope. No, good. I'll just change in here. Out of these clothes. If only Horatio's sister can tell me about that ghost town. It's my only hope. There we are. All set as Superman. Up with this window. And out to Screen Run. Up, up, and away!
The climax of the $10,000 ghost will come to you in just a moment, so stand by. Gang, the newspapers told of a funny incident that happened recently in the city of Munich in Germany. The Munich Zoo acquired a new Paul parrot. Suddenly, one day last month, to the bird housekeeper's embarrassment, the parrot began screeching, Heil Hitler! Heil Hitler! Evidently, in the old days, when Hitler and his crazy theories were still popular, somebody had taught Polly to say that. And having nothing but a bird brain, the parrot didn't realize that times have changed. Today in Germany, only a Paul parrot would be dumb enough to go on heiling der Führer. But it wasn't so long ago when millions of foolish Germans believed and repeated all those nonsense theories that Hitler and the Nazis handed them. Rubbish about Aryan supremacy and how the so-called master race could lick the rest of the world. Yes, most Germans were Paul parrots in those days, screeching Hitler's slogans of hatred and prejudice. Well, you know where those ideas brought Germany, to war and defeat and final ruin. Over here, we've always been too careful to let some dictator make chattering parrots out of the rest of us. We've learned to think for ourselves and judge people on their individual merits. We know that the strength of our nation depends on that. Just to make sure we'd never forget that, our ancestors put the Bill of Rights into our Constitution. This as a protection for America against dictators. If anybody tries to make parrots out of us, we point to our Bill of Rights, and then we give them the bird. And now, back to the adventures of Superman and the climax of the mystery of the $10,000 ghost.
In the little ghost town bank, the suave man called Lucky has just emerged from the room in which Lois Lane, Horatio Horn, and Anton Lisinski were imprisoned. Carrying a sheaf of engraved papers and smiling broadly, Lucky approaches his dwarfed henchman, Shortcake, who, garbed in boy's clothing, puffs nervously at a large cigar. At the rear of the room, the other members of the gang are engaged in a dice game.
Now take a gander at these, Shortcake. $10,000 in grade A bonds, endorsed over to me by Lazinski.
Nice going, Lucky. Let's blow now, huh?
Well, what's your hurry?
Are you kidding? Them two Daily Planet reporters. The cops will be burning up the country looking for them.
I'll never find them here.
Look, Lucky, let's not push even your luck too far. The Daily Planet is big time. They'll do everything to find a lame Damon Horn.
I know it, Shortcake. I was only needling you. We'll finish up here and lay low for a while. We'll find another ghost town out west someplace.
Okay, but let's scram out of here fast.
All right. But there's a little job you have to do first. Three little jobs, I mean.
What job?
I dump Lazinski down in the cellar. Miss Lane and Horner down there, too. They got the door open somehow and fell into the cellar. You ought to hear Miss Lane bawling Horn out.
Hey, that's good. That's good.
Yes, out of the frying pan into the fire. So now, take your gun and go down there and finish him.
Oh, no. Not me.
Why not?
I ain't going down in that cellar. Those other six guys we knocked off are down there.
You afraid of ghost shortcake?
I ain't going down there, I said.
Okay. I was only kidding you. I'll send Ed down. He likes ghosts. The kind that pay us 10 G's, that is. Ed.
Yeah, Lucky?
Go down in the cellar and finish those three jerks. Then we'll be on our way.
Okay. What? Who's this guy in the funny clothes?
I don't know.
I'll tell you who I am later. Right now, I've got work to do downstairs.
Stop him, boys. Don't let him...
No. You ought to know better than to try to stop me. If you insist on playing rough, take this. And this. Stop tickling me with that lead. Bullets can't hurt Superman.
He's not lucky. He's Superman. Stop shooting and let's get out of here.
Oh, no, you don't. I'll just knock your heads together like this.
Oh, oh.
That'll hold Lucky Shortcake and company. Uh-oh, I've got to get down the cellar in a hurry. Down!
Oh, you leave us alone.
Put that gun down.
Superman.
I'll be with you in a moment, Miss Lane. Horn, you won't be good, eh? Okay, then. Pleasant dreams. There, guess that does it. Now.
Oh, Superman, you got here just in time.
Why, you certainly did. This ruffian was going to finish us like his gang did those six dead men across the cellar there.
Oh, poor chaps. I gather they're the men who disappeared so mysteriously.
That's right. Lucky picked his victims carefully. Bachelors recently from Europe who had some money but were lonesome for folks of their own blood. He told them that a young nephew or a young cousin that they'd never seen had just arrived in this country with a good deal of money.
That little rascal, Shortcake, posed as a young nephew or cousin.
Yes, and then these men could adopt the boy and control his fortune, too.
I see.
All they had to do was put up $10,000 to show that they were responsible people.
And when he got them out here, he took their money and then murdered them, eh?
And that's right.
It's so awful.
Yeah. Lucky charged those poor chaps $10,000 for the privilege of being liquidated.
That's right.
Well, let's go up and get Lucky and company and turn them over to the authorities. I'm quite sure the state will be happy to liquidate them for nothing. And so ends the mystery of the $10,000 ghost. Another transcribed Superman adventure mystery in the new half-hour series. Superman is a copyrighted feature appearing in Superman DC comic magazines.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY, Moorhead State Public Radio, 90.3 FM, where we just heard an episode of the classic radio series The Adventures of Superman that first aired on March the 4th, 1949. I'm Leon Smothers. Although The Adventures of Superman was written for a younger audience and aired at times to allow children to listen, the stories were so interesting and the production quality so high that it appealed to adults as well. In fact, one telephone survey of the period showed that 35% of the program's listeners were adults. In many cases, these were parents listening along with their children. And those parents, as well as teachers and community leaders, would certainly have approved of the values and social awareness the program sought to instill. I always think it's interesting to hear cast and crew talk about their experiences in radio. Here are Bud Collier and Joan Alexander again talking with Richard Lamparski.
Were there ever any great mistakes, terribly embarrassing mistakes made on those live shows?
You laughed, you got, I mean, it threw you to a certain extent, but everybody always pulled together so that, believe me, it was a live show and it's something you had to go through. And everybody rallied and thinking somehow the show got on with maybe the audience saying, what was that, you know?
Well, now, how much rehearsal would you have had when you did the Superman show? Well, it was 15 minutes.
For each show?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did a quick read-through sitting around a table. And then we did a dress rehearsal, and then we went on the air. About an hour and a half. But actually, the things that should be keepsakes today, and it would really be mementos of a forgotten past, were the dress rehearsals every day on that show. There was something about the way-outness of the characters we portrayed and the situations we found ourselves in that we used to camp and horse that dress rehearsal as far out as you could climb a piece of scenery. On the air, it all... But if we hadn't done that on the dress, to get the laughs out of our system.
Mm-hmm.
It could well have broken you up. It was so far out. But on the air, it all sounded real legitimate, and playing it that far out and seriously was the right thing to do. You know, so many people get a least bit embarrassed by fantasy when they're directing it or performing it, and it loses all the great charm it could have. But if played honestly and whole hog all the way, it's great.
For most of the time that the program was on radio, there was no on-air acknowledgement that Collier was the voice of Superman. Until very late in the run, the only mention of his portraying Superman was in a few newspaper and magazine articles. But even though their identities weren't given, the vocal presentation of Collier and Alexander became so identified with the characters that they were asked to do voiceovers for a series of 17 Superman cartoons produced by Fleischer Studios in 1941. And in the late 60s, they again provided the character voices for several TV cartoon shows. After radio faded, Collier became a TV game show host. His most popular shows included Beat the Clock, To Tell the Truth, Break the Bank, and Winner Take All. He also wrote two books. After 11 years as radio's Lois Lane, Joan Alexander appeared on television game shows, including 4 years on ABC's The Name's the Same. In addition to doing television, Alexander was able to return to the stage. She appeared on Broadway in several plays, including Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution in 1955 and in Poor Richard in 1964. She also did some Shakespeare and appeared in several regional theater productions. That brings us to the end of today's program. If it has piqued your interest in the early days of Superman, there are numerous sites on the internet where you can listen to his radio adventures. I would also recommend that you watch the Fleischer cartoons, which are available for viewing on YouTube. You've been listening to That Was Radio, where we discuss old-time radio programs and the people and events that shaped them. On this episode, we featured the Adventures of Superman radio series. I hope you enjoyed the program and will join me again next time. I'm Leon Smothers, and this is Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY 90.3 FM. Thank you.